Honeybee with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi and welcome to Robots episode 115. I am Jana and today will be all about Honeybee Robotics, a small spacecraft technology and robotics company founded almost 30 years ago by Stephen Gorvin and Chris Chapman. But first, as always, here are the latest robotics news with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. Researchers and engineers at NASA, the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, and the Oceaneering Space Systems of Houston have jointly developed a robotic exoskeleton. The robotic suit called X1 consists of two legs, each with two motorized and three passive joints, and a harness reaching up from the wearer's hip to their shoulders. The entire device weighs 26 kilograms or roughly 57 pounds. Its design is based on technology developed for NASA's humanoid torso, Robonaut 2, which is currently working with astronauts aboard the International Space Station. Unlike most current exoskeletons, the X1's main purpose is to inhibit movement in the leg joints. This will allow the device to be used as a training tool to reduce muscle atrophy in microgravity conditions such as those aboard the space station. The researchers also envision X1 playing the role of a traditional exoskeleton, providing additional force when needed, and coupling it to existing spacesuits to allow its use for surface exploration of distant planetary bodies. In other news, a host of new robots were introduced at last week's International Conference on Intelligent Robots and Systems, or IROS, in Portugal. They include a quadruped with inflatable limbs, two humanoids, the interactive Urban Robot or iUro and Samsung's RoboRay, as well as a series of robots that can be created out of amorphous materials, including foam, sandbags, or toothpicks. For more on exoskeletons, including photos and videos of 10 different devices currently in use or in the making, as well as a slideshow of the robots presented at IROS, have a look at robohub.org.
The Honeybee Robotics Spacecraft Mechanisms Corporation works on projects at the cutting edge of space technology, and some of their devices have already made it all the way to Mars. With clients ranging from NASA and the US Defense Department to Siemens, IBM and a whole host of other organizations, researchers at Honeybee Robotics are constantly working on a wide range of products and technologies. Our reporter Per spoke to the chairman of Honeybee Robotics, Stephen Gorvin, about the company's history, its products and its future.
So, welcome to the podcast. I'm here today with Steve Gorevan of Honeybee Robotics.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Per, and I'm glad you came, and I'm happy to talk to you.
Could you start how you got started in robotics and your first robotics, and then we can move on from there?
All right. The origin of the company Honeybee Robotics was quite specific, actually. It happened one night. And I actually was in graduate school at Columbia University, engineering department, and I had a eureka moment, literally, and it came to me that, believe it or not, that I had to start a robotics company. And I was reading an article about a French industrialist. This is how specific I remember this. I was in bed. And this idea just popped into my head. I can't find anything in the article that made that happen, but it did. And this idea was perhaps the fertilizer for this situation was that perhaps about 2 years earlier, my partner, the president of this company, Chris Chapman, who's down the hall, who's a financial guy, and he runs our finances superbly well, and I don't know what I would do without his friendship and partnership. When we went to school together at New York University, undergraduate, and when we parted, he had to go back to Ohio to a family business. He said, listen, and it was a strange thing to say because I was just a student. I thought it was strange. He says, if you ever have an idea for a business, you tell me, because apparently he had some kind of access to a small amount of cash, and he was, I'm just a student. I have no track record. He says, he had faith in me if I ever had an idea. I didn't think much about it because I never thought I would have an idea for a small business, but then I did this moment. And he flew out to New York. He was in Ohio, and we stayed up all night. And within days, we had incorporated, and he gave me a check. And we started the business with two students from Columbia. And we said to ourselves, the basic idea of the company was robotics was rather new in U.S. industry, because we weren't looking for a worldwide impact at that moment. And I had read that robotics, the manufacturers of robotics in the 80s, this is 1983 in the fall, there was a problem. And these magnificent machines were being built, but they were dumping them literally at the doorstep of U.S. industry. The industry was buying them and saying, we have to automate, but there was this gap. No one on the user side knew how to use these machines properly. So we said, let's be a middleman. We will take our knowledge of robotics, which is what we were studying at school, and we will say, we will be an in-between person. We will help, we will install them, and we will train the user, and we will, the manufacturers of the robotics will love this because we'll be using their machines. And typically when a robot is installed in a factory, it only represents about 20% of the sunk cost. There are all kinds of additional costs, machines to feed parts, conveyor belts, you name it, it just adds up. So we were able to become a systems engineering house that would put this whole thing together in a turnkey fashion for the user. And the very first time we went out to try to sell a robotic system to an American corporation, we went to a company not far from this location in Midtown Manhattan. And on the very first time we went out, we sold a system to American Hydron Company, which would make contact lenses out on Long Island. And I was driving back in a car, I said, this is going to be easy. But it wasn't until 14 months later that we made our second sale. So it was very, very difficult the next year. And I was getting calls from people that were close to me saying, I really need to. I felt like the doctor that was trying to revive a patient with the electrical paddles, and they were pulling me away saying he's gone, that I had to leave it. But I kept on trying and trying, and sure enough, we got someone who believed in one of our ideas, because by this time we were giving away the engineering, trying to interest the customers what we could do for them. So we were drawing up plans and being very specific. The risk was, of course, people could steal it. But I said, what the heck, we have to show them what we could do. And we found somebody that really liked what we were doing, and we got a rather large contract that kept us in business. And we were going along fine until 1986. And in 1986, two things happened. One, my secret childhood dream was to work for NASA. Now, it hadn't even entered into the business plan to work for NASA, because I didn't think that NASA was very interested in robotics per se. Now, I know that the Voyager spacecraft that had flown to the outer reaches of the solar system, these were called robotics, but they weren't they were just really, to me, programmable spacecraft. They weren't robots in the sense that they had end-of-arm tooling, joints that were measured in the degrees of freedom and so on, like we typically think of robotics today. So those kinds of robotics is what I was good at, and I didn't see them in use at NASA. But I always wanted to work for NASA, and then in 1986, I, for some reason, became possessed with the idea of going to see someone at NASA to see if they would, just on the off chance, I had to try it once. And Chuck Hoberman was working with one of the original workers at Honeybee Robotics, and my friend, and one of the founders, really, of the company. And he's the engineer who developed the Hoberman sphere, you know, that expanding and contracting sphere you see in a lot of airport gift shops. It's actually an incredible mechanism. And I thought, well, volume is very important with respect to spacecraft. The smaller things are, the better. So if you can have a deployable system that shrinks into the smallest space possible, then expands for perhaps uses an antennas in space that might unfold or solar arrays. Chuck had some really unique ideas about how we could make really compact deployable devices, compact so they can fit in rocket fairings. And I said, we have to go to NASA. We'd really have to give this a shot. So we walked into the office of the head of the structures branch at NASA Langley, Martin Michaelis Jr., who at this time was doing the path-breaking work on developing the space station, which is an incredible engineering achievement. And it was also radically different from any civil engineering project that had ever happened before in human history. And we stayed in his office for hours, and he warned me not to come because he said he had people from Japan coming who were experts in origami and things like that that they had to disappoint. But we sat there 3 hours and explained what we could do for him and some of the other deployable ideas we had. And lo and behold, he made me the happiest person in the world. He gave us a very small but very real contract. And I was so happy. I just cannot tell you how happy I was because I was working for NASA, my childhood dream. I even have a little essay when I was in, I had to have been 8, and I wrote this little essay saying, I want to work for NASA, I want to go to the moon. And I said, this had to be why I was so happy. And then it turns out, in that time we walked into the office, as we were walking down the hall after we'd received our first contract, Michaelis told me that you folks happened to walk in here at the exact right time. And I said, what do you mean? Well, what had happened the month before was the explosion of the Challenger in 1986. And apparently NASA, the space station at this time was on the drawing boards, but it was in the plans to deploy the space station and assemble it originally involved thousands of hours of astronaut EVA activity. And now all of a sudden, the directive from up high was to get involved in robotics because we cannot expose astronauts to all this EVA time, which is going to be equivalent to losing some astronauts. And right now, we don't want to lose any more. We want to keep it to an absolute minimum. So robotics are, he said, your company, he has a southern accent, and he said, your company has the right name on it, and because we were called Honeybee Robotics. And we got a whole flurry of contracts to help develop using real robotics, arms, end effectors to develop ways that we could build structures on orbit. And we were building mock-ups, working mock-ups in hangars down at NASA Langley. It was just beautiful. And we got so much work that we completely stopped working for U.S. industry. We had so much NASA work, and we never looked back.
Would you like to speak a bit about what you're doing in this new project that's going to land in just a few weeks?
Sure. This is a little slight a difference for us. We've gone, which I'm very excited about. Basically, we're doing two things on the Mars Science Laboratory. First, on Mars, the rock abrasion tool that we sent to Mars. One of the things that we had to equip the rock abrasion tool with was a brushing system that eliminated the cuttings that we were cutting, when we cut into the rock, we didn't want to just have left there a pile of dirt inside the hole we ground. So we developed a high-speed brushing, stainless steel brushing system that really brushed the rocks clean after we ground into them. In fact, you don't see any signs of any of the cuttings in any of the targets we've gone into. These brushes have been so effective. In fact, they were so effective, the brushes, that the rock abrasion tool, because the grinding heads were consumable and the brushes less so, although the brushes did exhibit somewhere, but not much, the brushes have been deployed on their own to brush away targets of all kinds, to just to get a better look at the surfaces and apply the instruments to where we brushed. It's sort of a poor man's rock abrasion tool. Well, these brushes were so effective that the descope that was planned for MSL was to make the soup, when the money got tight, we were saying, okay, just make it a brushing rat. And this is, we've developed what's called a dust removal tool, and that is aboard the, now aboard the arm on the Curiosity rover. But the second element that we've supplied for the rover is really the real big one that's making me quite nervous, like the rock abrasion tool did, was it's called the sample manipulation system. And, you know, of course your listeners can't see this, but I'm showing you a photograph of this.
So it's small vials, is this, and then it's a circle?
Basically, imagine something the size of a cake. It's circular, and it's a carousel. And there are these tubes, two rows of tubes around the periphery of the carousel, and each one of these tubes represents a sample acquisition site. And what basically our carousel does, it's a very sophisticated machine, and what it's going to do is accept samples from the rover has a scoop and a drill that makes cuttings. It's not like a core drill, but it makes cuttings, and or we can scoop dirt into a funnel on top of the rover. The funnel has a piezoelectric shaker. It shakes the dirt down through the funnel and into one of 74 carousel receptacle sites. And these, the system meters, tries to meter precisely about a tenth of a cubic centimeter of sample into each quartz cup. We use quartz because it's it's because the cup is going to be inserted in an oven and baked to 1,000 degrees, and the quartz is basically neutral. It's not going to give off confusing gases for the science instrumentation. But these cups will basically take the sample that's been deposited down the funnel, and it's going to move it to an oven site, and then the whole carousel lifts up to press the quartz cup into top of a chamber, and that becomes the quartz cup and the top of the chamber become an oven. But we have to have almost a hermetic seal with the top of that oven, so we have to apply with a great force. We also come in contact with tubing when we move into this oven position, and basically we cook the sample to 1,000 degrees, and gases evolve from the sample, and through an incredible series of valves and piping that are part of a part of a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, an evolved gas analyzer, and a tunable laser spectrometer. Each of these are instruments. And the piping network can take gases from the oven that we brought the samples to with our device. And they can be analyzed in a variety of ways using these instruments that I mentioned. And this suite is called Sample Analysis at Mars, or SAM for short. So SAM is undoubtedly the most important instrument of all the instruments on the Curiosity rover, because SAM is the instrument, and we didn't do this on MIRTH, SAM is capable of investigating organics. And we use the word organics to mean we were asked to only say the word organics, because no one wants to take the leap to what we're really looking for here, which might be some evidence of life having been on Mars or existing. What we're really studying is the habitat. Has there been or ever been signs that life was habitable for life? And this is sort of the way the payload, this instrument suite is constructed. But getting back to our role, so we are supplying this carousel, which is made up of hundreds of components. It's very sophisticated, and it also has some sites that actually have cups that are covered with foil. There are six sites that are covered. The cups are covered with foil, and inside are some chemicals. And we're actually going to use the. We're going to direct our machine to move at when the scientists determine that they want to try to look for amino acids. We're going to use these precious six cups and use our device is going to pierce that foil and deposit the sample inside these chemicals. And we're going to do what's called wet chemistry experiments on the surface of Mars. And, you know, years before we were doing this project, we used to try to we were in the robotics business. It's a new business. It's a new technology, relatively, in the last 30 years. So, it's to my mind, it's still relatively untouched when you look at all the industry worldwide that where robotics might be used and for the reasons it might be used. One of them that interested me in the early days. Years ago was the pharmaceutical industry. To me, if one goes to a pharmaceutical company anywhere in the world, and also in many, many universities and government laboratories, there are what these systems that are called sample preparation systems. And basically what they are what we've sent to Mars. It's an analytical laboratory system designed to do analysis on something you've made or something you've found, results of a test, tissue. But basically, these are a variety of a laboratory where you can put specimens through a variety of precise chemical tests, and you can move samples down a line. We tried to automate that, and we said we can go to these large Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, just to name a couple of companies that have sample prep systems, and probably hundreds of them worldwide. We said we could make this more precise, we think, using a robot. And it turned out we did automate a couple of them. It turned out to be very, very complicated. But the astounding thing is that the most complete sample prep system that we ever did was not inserted in the laboratory on the Earth. It's the one we're sending to Mars. And this is a little unusual, too, because usually you want to do things on the Earth, tried and true many times with robots, before you try it on another planet. Now, we're sort of skipping a step. We're sending this incredible sample preparation laboratory to Mars, and all the harsh conditions that we have, the temperature range that we've got to withstand is like 100 degrees swing possibly in one day. We have incredibly fine dust getting into everything, and no matter how we try to seal things, that this dust is going to migrate through these seals eventually. And what that worries the designers is about mechanisms. You're sending mechanisms to Mars. This mechanism of the SMS is three axes have movement, and it's really a robotic system, really, because it can be called a gun. So many different tasks that it's worrisome that there's going to be all that dust around and those temperatures, not to mention the rigor of launch. The launch vibration environment is extremely violent, and so you're sending a complex mechanism with hundreds of parts through that environment. No one's ever really done it before, and not something that operates electromechanically at the surface of another planet. This is a brand new. So the SMS system is going to work on Mars. Probably the plan is, by the way, I'm personally going to be at the landing, which is the night of August 5th local time in California, will be at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and what you know, my job is to be. I'm part of the SAM. This name of this instrument is SAM, as I said before. I'm going to be a part of the uplink team that will send commands to SAM to do its science. And as the SMS is a subset of SAM, I that's why I was selected to be one of the uplink people, called a PUL, a payload uplink lead. And I think that the plans are shifting as I'm speaking here, because they're you know, you'd think that NASA has every early day planned out exactly, but they really sort of had I'd say it planned out to first order of detail. But now we're getting closer, and we're looking at some of all the things we want to do in the first few sols, and we think now that in the third sol we're going to send command to Mars to see how SAM is, it's called a live test, and we're going to see if it survived. Of course, we're all pretty confident that if the rover gets on the surface, SAM will survive, but still we'll be sweating bullets waiting to hear that it has. And then a few days, sols later, we'll do an electrical baseline test where we test all the make sure all the electrical lines on SAM have survived. And then somewhere, perhaps near towards the end of August, we will move the SMS to make sure that it's functioning well. And that's going to be a really hairy time for us, because I think about all the violent the violence of the launch, that trip through the cold of space, and the violence of the landing. You know, and it has all these moving parts. It's just going to be very worrisome. But we will check that out near the end of the month, and then first solid sample, as it's called, the first introduction and analysis of a sample that we transport with our system, which will be a big event for the whole Curiosity payload, is probably going to be in sometime in September.
Very interesting, very interesting. And this is right now.
This is right now, and when I go to, just as we did with Mir, I enjoyed one of the aspects that I enjoyed more than I thought I was going to be enjoyed was living on Mars time. It was discovered during the Pathfinder mission, which was a technology demonstrator, really, that was sent to Mars in 1996, where we first saw our first American rover, Sojourner, which only went 30 yards in travel. And think about, I've forgotten the number of how many miles we've gone and kilometers we've gone on with Opportunity and Spirit, but we've come a long way, and I expect
just the fact that you measure it in miles rather than yards would tell us that there is.
Yeah, really. And but the Pathfinder folks learned. They tried to come to work every day, living in a 9-to-5 world, trying to. But see, the rover has to also live on a 9-to-5 world, because it has to. It's a solar powered mission, basically, or a daylight mission. It gets up in the morning, does its thing, and sends its telemetry home in the afternoon. But the problem is that the Mars day and the Earth day are out of whack by 39 minutes, and it's continually. If you land when it's on and it's morning on the Earth and it's morning on Mars, that's fine for a few days, but eventually the Earth day is advancing with respect to Mars. And it turned out that the engineers who are working Pathfinder, who tried to live on California time and tried to work within the rover's time, they got all out of whack. Their diurnal circles got all screwed up. I mean, they physically suffered more than the normal stress of a mission. And there was almost a strike after 30 days, because these guys were so affected by this by the disruption of the diurnal systems. With Mir, it was decided we were going to live on Mars time and forget about California time. Forget about it. Just, we were given watches, some of us, that where we strictly work on Mars time. is it just in the morning? You look at your Mars watch, see what time it is on Mars. Forget about, and I literally forgot what time it was outside. At first, they wanted to blacken our hotel windows. The windows are blackened in the control rooms. But they don't want us to see the sunlight and the darkness outside. They just want us to think about keeping the blinders on. But I forgot, even though I did see sunlight, I forgot local time. Although I did wear another watch in case I had to check to call my kids or something. But I didn't prefer that watch much. So I enjoyed that. I just got a kick out of it. And we're going to do that again for the first 90 sols on Mars of Curiosity. It's decided that it's going to be much more advantageous. And we're going to be on site, working in Pasadena and staying in Pasadena for the first 90 days. It'll be short trips back to go home and somebody take our place for a little relief. But basically, we'd be there most of the time. And then after 90 sols, just as we did with Mir, eventually, we've learned, you learn how to control it using a sort of a bridge from normal time, from Earth time to Mars time. But it's deemed that it's going to be too complicated to do that right away. It's a new payload, entirely different payload. We've got a whole set of different kinds of operations going on, and we're going to be all there doing that. But I look forward to that. in fact, it's like a dream come true. I to be able to go to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and to send commands to Mars for something that you had a part in building, I can die now.
Oh, we hope not. Where do you think you're going? What are you going from here on?
Well,
both short term, what's the next project, and longer term as it.
Well, Honeybee is maturing. We used to be overwhelmingly after our involvement with the space station development in 1986, we became 99% of our work was for NASA, but. We've become sort of approaching middle age in terms of a company, and so we've had to branch out and not particularly put all our eggs in planetary exploration basket, although I think we're doing some very exciting things in other areas. And one of them was actually a sort of a fascinating story. I can't tell you too much about it because we signed proprietary agreements with a customer, but I can say is that we've been brought back into the private world a little bit, and one of them was in an interesting way. And that way was, despite the fact that we are a small company, we have a little less than 50 people spread between three offices. Have the greatest concentration of planetary sample acquisition and drilling expertise anywhere in the world. Of course, that's an extremely narrow niche, but we're the best in the world at it. And it's fun. A lot of people here take great pride in the fact of being best at something. So, people, I guess, read about it. No, I got this phone call from a woman a few years ago, and she had an Australian accent, and it turned out to be a representative of one of the great mining companies of the world. And to make a long story short, she said, look, you are involved in putting a rover in a hostile environment and taking samples, having them analyzed in situ, and radioing the back results. We want to do the same thing in the outback of Australia, a hostile environment. We cannot get people to go out into these environments with the degrees that are necessary to do the analysis. We're going to, with you, build a remote vehicle to operate in the outback, to drill, to take samples, and to have them analyzed, and the results sent, instead of to the Earth, they're going to have to be sent back to a central location in Perth, where we'll have the experts who will be able to interpret the analyses that we're getting. And so we've become sucked back into the private sector, but I'm enjoying it because we're seeing I never thought really that we'd have this, that all we're learning on Mars and with our preparation work for sampling and sample acquisition, we're actually, I just didn't think an earthly application of what we were doing there would come up, but it has. So that's one of the exciting things we're doing in the private sector, in the space sector. We've also become involved in the Orion project. Orion is the new deep space manned vehicle development that the United States is developing. In fact, not many people know it, but we're spending $2 billion a year to develop this spacecraft.
And when you're talking deep space, is that going to the moon or Mars or further?
Oh, certainly just leaving Earth's orbit.
The shuttle couldn't do that, so you need a...
The shuttle could not do that. And this will be a vehicle for exploring what we would call deep space. This vehicle, with its plans for adding, supplementary supply vehicles in its rear... It could go to Mars, could go to the moon. One of the early, and maybe the earliest application, the mission hasn't been really selected for this vehicle yet, is to go to an asteroid and rendezvous and perhaps land astronauts on an asteroid. So it's being developed. The primary contractor is Lockheed Martin, and we're developing slip rings for transmitting power across the interface for the all-important solar arrays on this spacecraft, and we're also doing some bearings, supplying some bearing systems that help these solar panels continuously move and face the sun at a right angle. What excites me about this is we've been around the space program for a long time, but now we're so well, we have a great reputation, but to not get involved with a manned spacecraft where the quality control is off the charts, nothing can go wrong. And, they're looking to us to join the team because we've sort of graduated, if you will, from the robotic spacecraft to the manned spacecraft. So I'm very excited about participating, in that project. And by the way, when I say slip rings, slip rings are essentially we're robotics expert, but we're robotics hardware experts mostly, not software. Although we do plenty of software here, but we've come up with ways to make robotic hardware new and innovative. And slip rings allows, basically, it's a term for passing power and data across a continuously rotating interface. And the reason we became sort of experts at this is because we've been working for decades now on developing wrists of robots that can continually roll, so that they might do everything from screwdriving functions, where a human has to rotate 180 degrees at the most to operate a screwdriver, a manual screwdriver. But we get to play God in a way and develop a wrist that can continually roll. But, well, you still have to transfer power and data, though, across that. If you're going to have a continually rotating interface, you're going to have all your electrical lines wind up and be a problem. So slip rings allow you to have a continuous motion. And so this is sort of... It's an interesting development. We've sort of been recognized for our robotics on a component level here, and we're getting this kind of work. Similarly, we've just finished a job for the Taiwanese Space Agency for hinges for solar panels, and these are the, when I say this, see, these are kind of like middle-aged company space projects that we do. But some of the more advanced, more new type of jobs we're still involved in, and I think the two that come to mind is that we've invented two things for CubeSats. Now, CubeSats are basically micro spacecraft that's becoming a hot new thing now, and these are spacecraft that are literally the size of you know, 20 centimeters on a side, a cube, 20 centimeters on a side, that's small. But we're able to, now we're looking at being able to pack a lot of instrumental punch in packages that size. And so what we've, and the idea would be that we're, you know, you're sending up a larger spacecraft, well, you can fill the, these lots of excess space. Remember I said before, space is more important than mass. We can put a lot of extra small spacecraft in a payload. And the Defense Department has become interested in, NASA's become interested in CubeSats, and private enterprises become interested in CubeSats. And so we've invented and are continuing to develop our miniature, very small control MIMET gyroscopes that are compatible with CubeSats. And also we've invented the basically the world's smallest solar panels for a spacecraft, and I can, you know, they're just funny to see. They're just so tiny, and we're really moved down into the small sphere. So we're very excited about becoming involved in the CubeSat wave, and perhaps the newest and most radical thing we're working on now is what's called the Phoenix program. And the Phoenix program is a it's a brand new effort being sponsored by DARPA. And DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Project Organization. And DARPA is this, they're supposedly, you know, the government agency that, that really did give us the internet and countless other amazing things. And their charter is basically, we want to develop something fast, radical, and make it work. And I just love that kind of a notion. We've done some small research for DARPA over the years, but this, we finally hit the big time. And what the Phoenix project is to finally, I mentioned it before in the 80s, that the notion of servicing satellites, moving them to different orbits, perhaps catching and dispensing debris on orbit, we it looks like this could be the really great opportunity to actually get a foothold in this area. Because my feeling is that, and I'm sure the other people who are involved in this shares it, that we just need to show that we can do this. It is one of the peculiarities of the space business, is to do an innovation, one has to, you get to become in front of program managers and say, we want to fly this. And then the program managers say, where have you flown this before? Well, of course, if you've done something, if you're working on something brand new like we do here, the answer is we haven't flown it before. And in fact, the so, you know, that the technology that gets into space is done only on a very incrementally. NASA very rarely takes a leap and flies brand new technologies. If they have, when something new appears on orbit, it's usually has what's called a very high technology readiness level on the Earth. And that level is at minimum, we haven't assigned numbers to these things, it's minimum of 6. Before they even NASA would consider flying it. Interestingly, the rock abrasion tool is a very, very rare case, just parenthetically here. The rock abrasion tool was decided to become a payload element at a TRL level of 2, which means it was essentially not more than a whiteboard sketch when it was decided this will be on board. So that's very, 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 very rare, and it was one of the, probably one of the reasons why, I'm extending my paragraph a little bit here, that not many people knew about the RAT or involved, because it wasn't in the forefront of all the technologies. We were way, way, way behind. But it was decided we want it. So the TRL 2 thing flown. But this is, I can't think of another example where something at TRL 2 was able to fly. But with DARPA behind you, DARPA is, in a way, fearless. They will be able, they've got the kind of clout and track record and smart people to say, we're going to get over this hump. We're going to bring technologies that do not have a track record in space, and we're going to get them all together, and we're going to fly a demonstrator and of basically a spacecraft that has robotic arms on it, and it's going to go out and refuel, salvage. It's direct task set is not exactly set, but it's basically a satellite servicer and perhaps a debris collector. It's finally going to happen, and Honeybee again has been the honor of really of developing much of the end of arm tooling on this device, and I'm very, very, very excited about that.
Thank you very much for being part of the podcast.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
And that's it for this episode. Remember to check out the additional information, pictures, videos, and transcripts on our website at robotspodcast.com. Our next episode will air on the 2nd of November. Until then, goodbye. Honeybee with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.